Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, I'm Nicola Cairncross, and you're here at Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by Teresa, Heather, Pat, Linda, and Stephanie.
Hello.
Hi.
So today we're talking about all things spiritual, and I'm going to be joined by Pat, who's going to read her work in progress, and then Heather's going to share a word of a week with us. We've got a fantastic interview with J.F. Penn, who's written many exciting spiritual thrillers, I think she might call them. And then Steph and Anne Landman of the Chimera Festival are going to be sharing what's on their bedside table. But first, Teresa is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Okie dokie. Pen's poised.
Yes.
Published in 2005 and set in contemporary and medieval France, this novel takes its title from Greek mythology.
Got it.
Oh. Good. It's about time we had an easy one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. In the 2006 British Book Awards, this book was awarded Best Read of the Year. According to the Sunday Times, it was the second best-selling book in the United Kingdom in 2006 after The Da Vinci Code, selling about 865,400 copies in paperback. And it has something else in common with The Da Vinci Code. Pat's still happy?
Yeah, Pat's got it.
Okie dokie, clue three. In the Pyrenees Mountains near Carcassonne, Alice, a volunteer at an archaeological dig, stumbles into a cave and makes a startling discovery. Two crumbling skeletons, strange writings on the wall, and a pattern. Pat?
Labyrinth?
Yes.
Kate Moss.
By Kate Moss.
Yeah, I haven't read it, and actually, if you'd started with the other two clues, I probably wouldn't have got it.
Yeah.
It was the first clue.
Yes, setting contemporary medieval France and taking, obviously, the myth of the labyrinth created by Daedalus in Crete. So, what does it have in common with the Da Vinci Code?
No idea.
No.
Well, it's a grail quest, as is the Da Vinci Code, at the end of the day. She uses the destruction of the Cathars as a backdrop for the story, which is basically a grail quest.
You're on to you now. You're going to read us the third and possibly final instalment of your short story, Coming Home.
Yeah, I am. This concludes the story of Joe, and he's just gone into the little local shop to make his purchases, his basics, and that's where we're going to start. So it didn't take him long to make his purchases, but as he left the shop, he noted that Mama Maria had already fallen asleep again. How old was she now, he wondered? She must be 80, surely. On his first visit to the village, she'd been his landlady. When the tourists had started coming, her husband, Yorgos, had converted his parents' old house into studios for the visitors. Joe was their first guest and a source of great interest. They expected families or older couples looking for a quiet holiday. So why was this young man there on his own? I'm nearly 40, he protested. You are divorced? Maria had asked, with typical Greek forthrightness. When he had assured her that there was no wife, no children, she decided that he needed looking after, bringing in food, collecting up his washing and returning it ironed, chiding him for not wearing a hat when he got a little sunburnt. At the end of his 2 weeks, he left with gifts from Maria and Yorgos and a promise to return, a promise he'd been keeping for nearly 20 years. As he reached the small cottage, he felt a pang of regret. It was perfect. It was exactly what he'd dreamed of for so many years. Inside, he took a couple of cans from the pack he'd brought and opened the back door onto the garden beyond, where the smell of lavender mingled with that of thyme drifting down from the hills behind. Their barrenness formed a stark backdrop for the abundance of colour that filled this sheltered oasis. An old olive tree's silvered green leaves shivered in the slight breeze, while the darker green of orange and lemon trees were a vibrant contrast. as well as lavender, there were roses, yellow, red, and the palest of pinks that had been left to run riot. Dominating it all was the glorious cascade of the magenta bougainvillea. His fist tightened on the can he held, and his eyes clouded for a moment. He downed the rest of the contents in one. He would not let himself give in to self-pity. He'd been through that phase when he'd been first diagnosed just over a month ago, when his consultant had told him that the cancer was too far advanced, that it was just a matter of time. How long have I got? He'd asked. Maybe 6, maybe 12. Hard to predict. Chemo followed by a course of radiotherapy. No. If it won't cure me, there's no point. I don't want to spend what little time I have being sick. So he read the leaflets, quietly went about putting his affairs in order, and decided that for as long as it was possible, he would continue with his plans. He also decided that he would tell his friends only when it was necessary. He didn't want them treating him like an invalid, tiptoeing round him. Until then, he would live his dream and make this place his home.
Oh, that's so sad. That's so sad.
And I think the reason when I sort of sent it out and I said possibly the final piece was I wasn't entirely sure that it ended as well as it could do. And I was like, wait and see what you lot say.
Well, I found as an ending completely believable, unexpected, not where I thought the story was going, but beautifully written, that paragraph where you described the flowers, the olive trees.
Oh, that was amazing.
You know, so for me it works.
Just for me too. I didn't see it coming either.
Yeah, you've got a very definitive way of making sure we can't nag you anymore about writing it into a novel.
Well, a lot can happen in a few weeks in a novel. That's if true. You wanted to make it something. Yeah.
Just on a sort of continuity point, I remember in the bit when you talked about how he'd come to Greece, you talked about his parents died and left him some money, and he suddenly realised that he could go early. And I think this is probably a little bit at odds with that. So you might want to revisit that paragraph because...
He could still have made that decision early in the year.
But the irony is... Yes,
And then he gets the diagnosis.
Okay, well, I think if that's the case, then you might want to foreshadow it in that paragraph, saying he decided that he could go early. Otherwise, it kind of looks like, to me, it looks like a continuity error.
You'd forgotten what you'd written.
But anyway, that's a minor thing. I hesitate to bring this one up. I may have got it all wrong. But at the end of his 2 weeks, he left with gifts from Maria and Yorgos and a promise to return. So did Maria and Yorgos promise him to return? Have we got a comma in the wrong place, or have we missed?
Oh, you're brave.
I am brave, yes. Taking on the grammar police. Yeah. I'm asking the question.
I thought about that because he left with gifts from Maria and Yorgos.
Right.
And he left
with a promise to return.
No, with his, yeah.
And he promised to them that he'd return.
He left them. I thought it was fine, actually.
Yeah.
But
I must admit, when I sort of reread it after I sort of finished, I thought, is that entirely
right? I was very excited when I saw that. On an Oxford comma or a point of grammar.
No, it wasn't that. It's just the agent of...
Who extracted the promise.
Right. Yeah. Wasn't entirely clear.
No.
The first phrase, it did not take him long to make his purchases. I made a note that I felt that was strangely formal diction. But when you read it, you read, it didn't take him long to make his purchases, and it didn't sound formal at all. In other words, you didn't read it exactly as you wrote it. But also purchase, you know, make his purchases is quite a formal way of saying do his shopping.
Yeah.
Just... You know, these are very, very little things.
Yeah. And you said didn't, whereas when you just read what it says.
This is an interesting thing you bring up here, because I'm never very sure. Is it acceptable to use abbreviations of words like that unless it's in prose as speech?
I think it is okay. I think it's quite old-fashioned to say, to write, it did not, it was not.
Oh, okay. It depends on the narrative voice you're creating,
obviously. Yeah. Which is, you know, I felt it was a little bit formal. Yeah.
Can I try another one?
No!
Go for it.
Inside, he took a couple of cans from the pack he'd brought.
Yep.
Well, he just bought it, hadn't he?
Yes.
And he brought it in.
Yeah, he brought it from the shop, but he bought it at the shop. Yeah. So
I think bought is right.
He drove
that bought. The idea there was because in my head there was going to be another little bit before that where he'd made all these purchases and they're going to deliver. And I was going to put this little bit in.
He brought some of it with him.
The beer, right. And then I kind of rethought that.
The only other thing that I made a note of, where you say as he reached the small cottage, he felt a pang of regret, it was perfect. And I thought that was a lovely, subtle change of tone.
Mm.
But I just thought, pang of regret, is that a cliche?
Yeah, it is. I thought a stab of regret, but then I thought...
Yeah, that's a little bit
less cliche.
Right, so let me get this right then. So pang of regret's a cliche, but a stab of regret's not a cliche.
Well, no, it's not because it's original.
What's a... remind me of definition of a cliche again.
A cliche is a hackneyed phrase that's been overused. Like, you wouldn't say Brianne was white as a sheet because that's an obvious cliche.
Yeah.
But, and do you know where cliches come from?
No, I don't. As a matter of fact,
okay, well, in the olden days of the printing press, when they had common words and phrases would be put into what was called a cliche.
So they didn't have to make up
the words. As green as grass.
Yeah.
But lots of other things, you know, like Western Front and stuff like that. That would be made up so that you didn't have to individually put all the letters in. You'd just take the whole ready made up thing. And that was the cliche.
That is really fascinating. It's amazing. So pang of regret, it's up there. Ready made.
And those words that were already joined were put into something that was called a cliche.
Yeah, well, you know the block that you put it on is actually a cliche.
Oh, I know. I learn all the time, I do. Yeah. I just wanted to say that it seems that Pat has a habit of ending her stories with someone dying.
She's not being bullied into making them into a novel. Kill them off.
Well, there are only so many endings, you know, a death, an inheritance, a marriage.
Sailing off into the sunset in a spaceship.
Thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
So now we're going to go over to Heather for Word of the Week. But before we do, Linda's been showing an unhealthy interest in our analytics, haven't you, Linda?
I have. I want to know who we're reaching and where we're going. And it's just always so gratifying to look at these figures and this thing.
And we are. Do you want to give a shout out to one of our lesser known listeners?
Absolutely. We have so many different countries here and they're always so much fun. And I would like to say hello, those of you out there in Finland.
Very good. I'll give you one more.
Oh, okay. How about Nigeria?
Yay! Hello, Nigeria.
Finland. It's your week this week.
Yeah, we're so happy to have reached such a broad audience.
It's exciting. Over to you, Heather.
Well, I was actually wondering why the word want is WON'T is the shortened version of will not, but why is it not WILLT?
Willn't.
Yes. So I looked up the meaning, and when I looked up won't, he just said that it means will not. But if you know isn't, doesn't, all the other words that I could think of, just the apostrophe replaces one missed or usually one missed letter. I found a piece called Motivated Grammar, and I believe it is written by Gabe Doyle, an American gentleman. And I've actually printed out the article itself. And he says, in a previous post about apostrophication, I was asked why the contraction of won't for will not isn't WON'T with apostrophes in each position where letters have been deleted. In so doing, I skirted the obvious and much harder question of where the devil that O comes from. Why is it want and not wint or willn't? I had hoped to avoid this, but I've been called out by a commenter on a previous post who slags the use of patterns of English spellers. Surely, if won't is derived from will not, it should be willn't or not won't. Not what want should be a word in its own, in my opinion, even if it is not at least spelt the thing correctly. The English language has become very lazy with apostrophes and spellings. It really bugs me. Back in the day, it wasn't yet set how to pronounce or write the model verb that eventually became to us as will. The Oxford English Dictionary cites 33 different spellings just for the first third person singular form, running the gamut of will to well to ool and to wall. Some of these uses were more scattered than others, and it seems like a big division eventually came down to the will type usage versus the wall type usage, which lasted into the mid-1800s, and therefore will concern the model market.
Yeah.
I did feel that it was rather complicated explanation for something that was really quite simple, but as far as I know, it's the only one that doesn't use the actual letters of will not, as we said before, with perhaps, you know, sort of did not or whatever makes
sense. But it's come perhaps from walnot.
Yes.
Is what yes. the conclusion.
Walnut. Yes.
A different version of the word will. Well, interesting.
Thank you very much, Heather.
A pleasure.
Riveting as that was.
Oh, the sarcasm.
I'd like to have a little discussion about the title of this week's episode, because we have wrangled and unwrangled about this, haven't we, about what to call this one, because there are a whole body of work out there that touches on religious topics, spiritual topics. They're often thrillers, and I know, Steph, you've got a few examples to give us.
Well, the whole of the Narnia Chronicles has a kind of quasi-religious theme to it, and I wouldn't call them religious fiction, but
I would.
Would you?
There's a definite agenda of, you know, an allegory, a Christian allegory underpinning the Narnia books.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah.
Which I think is
Does
different.
Does that make them religious, though?
Well, I think the writer's intention was religious.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's different to something like the Da Vinci Code or the Labyrinth, which is touching on religious ideas, but using them to make thrillers. They're not really about religion, or they're not really interested in converting you to a religion or propagating a religious idea, which the Narnia books do propagate a religious point of view, as do the very dreadful, and I'm sure some of our listeners were brought up on this just as I was, Uncle Arthur's Bedtime Stories, which are foul, but very, very religious.
What made them foul, dare I ask?
Oh, they're full of, you know, mothers starving themselves to death for the sake of their children.
Oh, and,
you know,
martyring themselves.
Yes,
yeah.
Yeah.
And these were for little children?
But, you know, I would say those books do have a religious mission and intention, whereas there's a difference between books which are using religious themes, religious material, myths associated with religion, like the Grail. You know,
so we mentioned in a previous episode about the Grail quest type story, and then there seems to be, to me, because I've read quite a lot of these, well, quite a lot, there's some sort of conspiracy theory subplot going on in a lot of them as well, about things like the Knights Templar.
The Knights Templar is often basis for novels, and in the case of the Kate Moss book I mentioned earlier, it's the Cathar, a religious group in southern France, that is a rich source of material for writers, but, you know, it's not necessarily foregrounding their religion or their religious ideas so much as, you know, in the case of the Da Vinci Code, it's this myth about the bloodline of Christ and so on.
Enduring this myth.
Absolutely.
And also there are the books written in set in monasteries and things. You know, there's a detective story set in a...
Do you mean The Name of the Rose?
Yes, that might be the one. Umberto Eco.
The Name of the Rose, I mean, it's a long time since I read it, but there's a little bit of Sherlock Holmes in there. It's a little bit of that style.
There's a monk and his sidekick, isn't there?
Yeah, and there's a murder or murders or apparent murders. But, you know, Umberto Eco is also quite an intellectual writer, so there's a lot of stuff about Aristotle and the lost books of Aristotle. I think it kind of fits into that category.
Makes me think of the Cadfael.
Well, I think the Cadfael isn't really about religion, it's just the setting.
Right.
It's the historical context, in my opinion. It's about this sort of civil war that's going on in England at the time, and there's the backdrop. And, you know, there's this whole genre of the historical detective novel, and there are lots of them. Cadfael's a very good example.
Mm. Oh, we'll put that down for a subject in the future.
I think we should,
yes. I read The Children Act. It's about Jehovah's Witnesses, and I found it fascinating. So I found it quite moving.
So could you call it political when people write those kind of books? They're trying to make a statement about religion.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sway opinion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it seems like we've got books that are set with a religious backdrop. We've got books that are about some sort of morality theme. Mm-hmm. Then you've got books that are supernatural and spiritual. And so it's a really wide genre, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And books promoting religion or promoting ideas for or against a particular
religion, or challenging
yeah.
ideas,
so, which is a kind of politics.
Okay, so we're lucky enough to have an interview today with a very successful author who writes spiritual thrillers, supernatural fiction, J.F. Penn. Let's go over to the interview, shall we? So today I'm delighted to be talking to J.F. Penn, who is an incredibly successful author. Good afternoon, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm very excited to be talking to you. How did you get started? How did you find out you were a writer? And how did your writing career develop?
Oh, a lot of questions. okay, so I write thrillers, so action adventure, conspiracy thrillers. I also write crime, as well as dark fantasy and horror. So I have a number of different series. I have 18 books at this point under J.F. Penn. I started writing fiction, I mean, maybe this might help some listeners, but I started writing fiction during NaNoWriMo back in 2009, I think it was. So NaNoWriMo, if people don't know, National Novel Writing Month, and essentially it's every November, and the aim is to write 50,000 words, and I managed 20,000, and that was a lot for me because I'd never written any fiction since school, really. And out of those 20,000, probably 5,000 ended up in the final manuscript sort of 15 months later after a lot of writing and editing. And that book is out there as Stone of Fire, which is the first book in my arcane thriller series. So sort of solving supernatural mysteries around the world. So that's how I got started. And I was still working a day job back then. I used to be in business and finance and IT. And then I left my job in 2011. So since 2011, so almost 8 years now of being a full-time writer, and I write fiction and non-fiction and do other things too.
That's incredibly prolific. So you've written 18 books in 10 years, essentially.
Well, I've actually written 28 if you count my non-fiction as well. But the it's interesting, the definition of prolific, because if you take some of the best-loved authors in the world, someone like Nora Roberts, she puts out a book every 31 days. So, you know, the question of being prolific is really about how many hours do you spend writing every day. So people, when you start out, so if you, like, that first book took me 15 months, and I had a day job, and I was doing other things, you know, life, and building up my website and doing that type of thing. But, you know, I wrote that and got it out there and edited it and everything in that time. Now it takes me about 3 months to write the same amount, the same length book. But obviously I'm full time. So when I write, I can write 2,000 words a day and it's a lot more finished. So I would say the word prolific is really interesting, especially if you look at people like Enid Blyton or Aldous Huxley, who wrote 400, 500 books in their lifetime, or even R.L. Stein, the kids author, R.L. Stein. He is the most prolific author alive today. But certainly Nora Roberts, who also writes mysteries with J.D. Robb, she's kind of, you know, a hero in the fiction community, you know, traditionally published as well. They have to publish her under two names because she's so prolific. But then there's also a rumor that Stephen King, because Stephen King writes every day, that he has a book in the drawer for every book he publishes because he writes so much.
Yeah. That's incredible. What prompted you to get going on that NaNoWriMo?
Well, I've always been a reader. I mean, I think occasionally someone will ask me, oh, I don't read, but I'd like to write a book. And I'm like, yeah, don't bother, because I just don't get how people can even do that. But so I always was a reader. I used to carry around books instead of teddies. You know, I just read. I'm an introvert. I'm happy reading. That's me, you know. But I think because I went to the University of Oxford, and also my mother was an English teacher, so I'd been brought up in this very literary tradition where, with fiction, the only, you know, good in quotation marks book would be a prize-winning literary novel. And, you know, I remember reading and studying a lot of literature. And so I thought I could never write something like that, because the definition of literature, you know, will vary, but inevitably it takes a long time to write. It's very dense, it's, you know, might be quite poetic. And I still love reading literature, but actually I was doing this job I hated. I was miserable in my day job, and the only thing that kept me going was reading on my commute. So I would read thrillers on my commute to my job. I would read thrillers in my lunch hour. I would go to the bookstore. I would buy more thrillers. I'd come home, watch a bit of TV with my husband, and read more thrillers. And so I was reading these books to escape the part of my life that I was miserable in. And what happened was I started writing nonfiction. My first book was called Career Change, which was about trying to find a job that you love. And amusingly, I ended up finding writing and publishing. But when I was kind of going through that, I kind of realized that the books that I read to escape, maybe I could write a book like that. Maybe I couldn't write, well, and maybe I will one day, but I didn't want to write a literary novel. I actually wanted to write a book like Dan Brown, The Da Vinci Code, which kind of came out around then. And I was like, this, you know, I have a master's in theology. I have this background that could be, I've traveled all over the world. So the impetus really came from a realization that I could write for someone like me, someone who was stuck in a job they hated, or maybe they just wanted to escape their life for a bit. And that to me is the essence of genre fiction, escapist Netflix. It's all the same gaming, you know, it's all the same way for someone who is, you know, needs to just escape, whatever reason it is. So once I had that realization that I could write entertainment, it didn't need to be so serious. And this is a big problem, I think, with writers. We all take ourselves so seriously. And I was like, I'll just write a thriller. And so I did. And that's since then, that's kind of what I do. I write books that I want to read. And yeah, that's fun.
So do you, how do the ideas come? And what kind of research do you do? And how do you keep them coming?
Well, I think the amusing thing is, I think once you start writing books, you have so many ideas, it's hard to capture them all. So mostly my ideas come from my travels. And so Stone of Fire opens in Varanasi in India, at the Burning Ghats, where they burn bodies. And I'd never seen that before when I traveled to India. It's not something we have in England. So I was, that is a memory that sticks in my mind. And when I thought about the opening scene of what would be a religious conspiracy thriller in the vein of Dan Brown, I was like, I'm going to write about Varanasi. So the idea for that, for my Arcane series, which is my kind of Dan Brown meets Lara Croft series, all comes from my travels. I've been to most of the places in all of the books, and there's 10 now in that series. Wow. And if there's a place I want to go, so the last one, which came out last year, Valley of Dry Bones, that came about because I was in New Orleans writing another book, and I went into the church, St. Louis Church in New Orleans, and at the back of the church was a Bible, the St. Louis Bible, and the original was in Toledo in Spain. And when I saw that Bible, I was like, that's weird. What is this Bible doing here? This particular Bible that had come from 12th century Spain. So then a year later, I went to Toledo to look at the original, and that then sparked an idea. And then when I was in San Francisco, I found this monk who had been in Spain, and this idea kind of came together. So for me, it's all about going places or research. I do a lot of research online, but most of my research is done by traveling places, because that's what I love. I mean, when I looked at what do I want to do with my life, it was read, write, and travel. So yeah. I try to blend them together, and yeah, it's a happy life. Most of my books are European. I've started to bring in, you know, I have a Destroyer of Worlds is about India. Valley of Dry Bones has a lot in America. And I have some more stuff about America, but it's interesting how our cultural history, our European cultural history, kind of sinks in over the years.
So you mentioned you've got a master's in theology. That's obviously informing some of the plot in your books.
Yeah, and a lot of ideas. You know, it's basically what fascinates me. I specialise in the psychology of religion, so why people believe certain things or why people do things in the name of God, which I'm really fascinated with. And my book Crypt of Bone really goes into some of that technology and a lot of brain stuff, temporal lobe stimulation, which is fascinating where you look at it in the context of science versus faith. And a lot of my books are, I don't know what I believe. So I write to kind of figure out what I believe. And, you know, I'm not of any particular religion. I don't go to church or temple or anything, but I do have, I would say, a spirituality where I absolutely respect all the different forms of faith, and I try to bring in those aspects of faith. So Destroyer of Worlds about India is very much the Hindu tradition, and some of those fascinating gods, and like Kumbh Mela, the huge march, the biggest pilgrimage in the world in India. So yeah, I think it does inform my stories and give me ideas. I also think, again, talking about Europe, like Spain, for example, a lot of my books have Spain in because I love Spain and I go there all the time. And it is deep with religious bloody history. I mean, you talk about horror, just go into a Spanish cathedral and you're going to see some pretty horrible statues and gory stuff. So, and the Spanish religious history is obviously fascinating and informs the USA. So I find a lot of ideas in history as well as when visiting places.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I'm completely obsessed with Professor Brian Cox at the moment.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
I watched a 3-hour interview he did with Joe Rogan recently talking about, you know, do aliens exist? Why, you know, does God exist? You know, and how science and religion are sort of often more and more now actually becoming intertwined in lots of ways.
The quantum type of level, yeah. But it is interesting. I mean, I think this is one of the most wonderful things about being a writer, and especially writing fiction. I do believe that you can see into someone's brain much easier through the lens of a novel. I mean, I just don't worry at all about anyone reading my nonfiction. But when people say, oh, you know, I'm going to read this novel, I'm like, well, maybe if you want to see into my brain, that's a good idea. But I'm not sure you want to.
Well, I've just ordered your first book now in the Arcane series.
Oh, well, that's quite I'd say that's quite tame. I mean, the Arcane series to me is thriller. My book Desecration, my London crime thrillers, I think also about finding your voice. This is an interesting thing about being a writer. I think it takes to book 5, and Desecration was my book 5. And I really think I was able to stop self-censoring. So this is something that's interesting to you. The expectations that the world has of you, that you have of yourself, it takes a while to kind of clear these things away and write something that maybe you don't think people might like, or something that might just be a little on the edge. So Desecration to me is a fascination with the human body after death. So again, the themes of death, but and I got the idea as I went to a medical specimen museum. So, wow. You know, body parts in jars. I'm sure everyone can see that. Body parts in jars.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got this kind of feeling in myself, what authors do, looking at these body parts going, I wonder if any of them were alive when they took the body part away. And then I have, that book opens with a murder in a medical specimen museum and goes into the history of anatomy. And the fascination with why do we get squeamish about body parts after death, when most of us, I think you would too, say that is not the person anymore. That
yeah,
is.
Absolutely.
But and then we same. But then why don't we just let body parts be in jars? Mind you.
Yeah, and you were saying about the whole, you know, Indian burning their bodies publicly, you know, in Britain it's very much hidden away, isn't it? I mean, very hidden away.
Yes, and I think sometimes this is damaging. I have an Irish friend, and she said that the Irish way of death is much more similar to, I mean, I think the Greek tradition, you know, they have much more of an open kind of wailing approach to death, whereas the British way of death is very reserved, don't talk about it, don't know how to, you know, express grief. So and this is what I think with fiction. As I said, I write entertainment. My aim is that you can read one of my thrillers and be taken out of your life. But equally, I still want to spend my time thinking about the deeper questions of life. So put a layer of interesting stuff underneath a thriller or a mystery. So my London series is a mystery detective solving crimes, but underneath that is a lot more depth, I think.
Absolutely, yes. Where can people find you if they want to come and see all your books?
Well, the best place is at jfpen.com, and that's F for Francis. And also, I'm on Twitter at jfpenwriter, and on Instagram, I love Instagram, at jfpenauthor. And yeah, and if people have questions or anything, I'm always happy to answer them. And also, you can find all my books in all the usual online stores.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, that was really interesting, wasn't it? Fascinating.
It was, yeah.
And we're coming to the end of the show now, but we've still got time to hear from Stephanie and Anne Lamman of the Chimera Festival what's on their bedside tables. So let's go to Anne first then.
So if I had a bedside table, which I don't, it would probably have collapsed under my to-be-read pile. I am currently in the process of programming our first festival, so I have a lot of books to read so I can make informed decisions about panels. So I've had a bit of a binge from Christmas onward, and I've read some great books. Samantha Shannon, who's one of our headliners, just published The Priory of the Orange Tree, which is a fantastic fantasy book, but 800 pages. But it is amazing. I cannot recommend it enough. So I've been blitzing through parts of our programme. I'm now reading C.A. Fletcher's The Boy and His Dog at the End of the World, which is a beautiful book published by Orbit later this year. So I'm terribly sorry this is a total teaser, because you won't be able to get your hands on this. It's a post-apocalyptic dystopian novel. Charlie Fletcher is an author and screenwriter based here in Scotland. I know him for his children's writing. This one is pitched slightly older, and it's basically what it says on the tin. World has come to an end. Very children of men. We can no longer have enough children, so we're dying out. And the same thing has happened to our dogs. Less dogs around. So it's this boy called Chris who lives on this island on the west coast of Scotland, real island, with his very small family. And this man comes to the island and steals his dog, his female dog called Jess. And he chases after this man in this just kind of mad spur of the moment decision. You have stolen my dog. He keeps saying, you have stolen my dog. You should not have stolen my dog. And it's written from his point of view. Looking back at the adventures he's had chasing after the man, and it's beautifully written, and there's these little snippets that he puts in that are foreshadowing what is about to happen to him, and you're just sitting there reading. I can only read it two chapters at a time because it just tugs at my heart so much. He speaks, and the way he looks back, because you know from the way he's writing, he's writing it as a diary, you know from the way it's written that something horrible is going to happen to him on his journey trying to find his dog. So it's heartbreaking. I really have to pace myself because I'm not that big a dog lover. I'm more into cats. But the way he writes it, he also looks back at the civilization that's gone. I think it's probably about 100 years after the end of the way the world as we know it. He kind of looks back and he describes what he found in all those left behind cottages and the way he reads books. He's a massive reader of books and he knows our world as we know it. Amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
Thanks very much, Anne. Now, Stephanie, what are you reading at the moment?
I am reading a book on Kindle called A Perfect Stone, and it's by S.C. Karakaltas. And I chose this for one of my reading groups because it's been on my Sundokus. I bought it last November when it first came out on Kindle. Mm-hmm. And I didn't buy the paperback because the paperback's 11 quid.
How much?
So it's available on Kindle for £2.22. I'm sure the paperback book price will come down, but I bought it on Kindle. And the reason I bought it is because it's about a little known slice of history. You know I like a bit of history. Yeah. It's about the Greek Civil War, when 38,000 Greek and Macedonian children were forcibly taken from their homes, mm-hmm. and nobody seems to know about this. I mean, there's lots of talk about the evacuation of British children in the Second World War, you know, children being sent to Australia and Canada to be made safe. But this is a massive event that happened in Southern Europe during the Greek Civil War, which came after the Second World War. It's been written by an Australian woman who clearly has some kind of Greek antecedents with a name like Kara Kaltas. I hope I'm doing it justice and pronouncing that. Teresa, tell me.
Well, I would say Kara Kaltas.
Kara Kaltas, there you go. It's told from the point of view of a guy called Jim, who's 80, and his suppressed memories surface when he finally confronts what happened to him when he was 10 years old, when he was Dimitri, and he was forced at gunpoint to leave his family and trek barefoot through the mountains to escape the Greek Civil War in 1948. So it is fiction, but it obviously has been very well researched, and I'm just starting on it and can't wait to get into it.
Man's inhumanity to man.
But yep. it is very contentious. You know, no doubt some children were kidnapped, but in other cases their parents very much wanted them to be taken to safety. Yes. So it's a very contentious issue. And in this case, we're talking about the communists taking children across the border. But on the other side of the coin, the fascists also, in inverted commas, rescued children to take them. The villages were being bombed and destroyed. It was like the Blitz.
In this book, they're not referred to as fascists and communists. Right. They're referred to as loyalists and royalists.
Yeah. Well, that well,
where
tells
they
you.
Were,
you know,
wherever yeah. they were, but, they should have made children walk across the mountain bare feet.
But anyway, a fascinating period of history.
Yes,
definitely
is.
I want to read that one as well.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Steph. So that's it. We've come to the end of the podcast for this week. It's been another fabulous episode. As ever, in closing, I'd like to encourage you to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or any of the other podcast platforms you enjoy. And please do tell a friend about us. That's how we grow. And if you've got time, just pop over to your podcast provider and give us a 5-star review, because that will help more people to find us and we can grow our family. Do come and join us on our Facebook group. So, from all of us here at Write Club, the podcast,
bye! Bye.